Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're in depth on what President Trump's Voter Fraud Commission is really all about. Here's something that has to be said at the beginning of the show. The incidence of voter fraud is so small as to be insignificant. And here are the numbers to back that up. The Brennan Center for Justice studied every federal election between 2000 and 2014. That means that they were looking at more than a billion votes cast over those 14 years, and they found 31 credible examples of voter fraud. 31. So why is the president launching a voter fraud commission? And that's a political discussion. What will the commission do? And that's what we're talking about now, and I hope you'll join in. If you're worried about voter fraud, is that a concern that comes from your political beliefs that can be supported by the evidence? Are there other voting issues that you think ought to be addressed by this commission? So I'd like you to take a little bit of a gut check this morning if you're about to call with a bunch of suggestions of voter fraud. Check in with yourself. Is this something that you believe because it fits with your political beliefs? Do you have evidence to support your great concern about voter fraud? Do you have serious questions about perhaps how it happens and why a commission has been created around it? Here's a phone number, 800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest, Van Newkirk, is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's been writing about the issue, and he joins us today from, where are you, Van? Are you in D.C.?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome back. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Justin Levitt is with us. He's a law professor at Loyola Law School, and he's with us today from L.A. And Justin, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks very much, Carrie. It's good to be here.
So, Justin, given that the Brennan Center could only come up with 31 examples in 14 years and a billion votes cast, can you give us a sense about why this has been an ongoing refrain from some politicians? And let me add this. I think an ongoing concern from some voters who are legitimately worried about this. Why does it keep coming up?
So I think you're right that there are people who are legitimately worried about this. And one thing to note, by the way, about that study is that was 31 examples of the sort of fraud that an ID rule could fix, and delivered in the context of people debating about whether people should have to show a particular form of ID at the polls when they go there. Mm-hmm. Other fraud does happen. But as you indicated in your lead, it's relatively small. It tends to happen not in presidential elections or in big statewide elections. It tends to happen in local elections. And it tends to be sort of some very old ways of proceeding, stuffing the ballot boxes, occasionally buying votes, that sort of thing. Why are people concerned about it? I think that there have been for a very long time, and this is more than a few decades, people who were interested in tightening up the rules around voting, sometimes to protect their own incumbency, sometimes to foster a different kind of electorate, have used the prospect of voter fraud to justify the sort of rules they want to put in place. And that's way back to the introduction of the ballot itself. You know, we used to have a system where you would just cast your vote on any old piece of paper, and people screamed about voter fraud, particularly in the big cities, to have the state take over production and preparation of the ballot. So this goes back, you know, hundreds of years, talking about worries about voter fraud in order to change the rules by which elections are conducted.
Van, a question for you here from Jerry, listening in Stillwater, Minnesota. Jerry, what do you want to say? What do you want to ask?
Well, you just started talking about other kinds of fraud, but there's several that I've been concerned about. Mm-hmm. One is absentee ballots. I've got a nephew severely disabled. Mm-hmm. He's old enough. There's no reason he couldn't vote, but he has an intelligence of a three-year-old. But his relatives, his mother, could easily vote for him any way she wants. But
she
it's
could,
still not
but
a
ha-
legitimate ballot.
Jerry, she could, but has she?
No, but I'm sure she. This is not the only situation. The
All right.
Others are extensions
Jerry,
of that.
Jerry, hang on one second. Let me ask about absentee voting here. Van, is that an example and an opportunity for potential voter fraud?
Well, I think instances like that, not just instances where you have, say, disabled people or people who don't have, say, the intellectual capacity to make informed choices, but you also have basic familial sort of coercion that happens often, and that's always been a part of voting. So often, say, husbands have forced their wives to vote a certain way, and those votes have basically just been tabulated alongside theirs, or they've forced grown kids to vote that way. So I don't know if that is actually something you can say is considered fraud or widespread fraud. I don't know if we have good data on that. But I think other things that happen, like irregularities in absentee ballots with people who register in two states, with people who accidentally cast votes twice, those get rolled up in fraud and all these conversations and hype around fraud. But they actually just tend to be mostly human error mistakes because voting is complicated in America.
Van, one of the things that President Trump has talked about and the chair of this commission, Kris Kobach from Kansas, have talked about is voters on rolls, on voting rolls that shouldn't be there, and opportunity for somebody to come in and impersonate somebody. Either they're deceased or they've moved away or they don't vote anymore, and opportunity for voters to come in and impersonate those people on the rolls. Is that a serious concern?
I think based on the proceedings of the commission itself, based on conversations I've had with secretaries of state, this is a problem. There are several state voter rolls that have people who are, say, registered elsewhere. People move all the time. It's a very mobile society. You're supposed to re-register as soon as you move, 15 days or whatever, but lots of people don't, or they don't unenroll from previous residences, and lots of people have. I think we saw people who are currently staffed in the White House now. They have registrations in multiple states. So it is a problem, but it's not one that needs to be solved by, say, implementing voter ID or these more restrictive voting laws.
And why
really,
not?
Because the Secretary of State is saying, basically, look, just give us better voting systems. Give us sort of a better way to digitally check whether somebody is registered in other states. Basically improve our state voter roll infrastructure, and we can do this without ever impeding on the actual rights of citizens. Secretaries of state have been saying, you know, we know this is a problem, and we can fix it.
Kansas's Secretary of State, Kris Kobach, has talked about exactly what Van has described here. He was on CNN recently. He was arguing that several million Americans have dual voter registration in two different states, and that is an indication of the fraud that's going on. And I wanted you to hear a little bit of this interview with the CNN anchor. Let's listen.
We have about 3 million people who are registered in more than one state, and that's
right,
not a crime. That's just an administrative bookkeeping.
Including the president's son-in-law, including the president's treasury secretary.
Exactly, yeah. And many of your viewers are probably registered in more than one state. But what is a crime is if you actually vote in both of those states or in more than two
of
states.
Of course it's a crime.
And every
but where
year,
is the evidence of this widespread,
right,
rampant, millions of people voting? If it had happened, why haven't we seen it, Secretary?
Well, I don't know if your network has covered it, but in my state, just people voting in Kansas and another state, my office prosecutes it.
So, Justin, this is a little confusing because we've just heard Van say, yes, this is an issue in some states. There are people on the rolls that shouldn't be there. Does that automatically mean, and that is leading to voter fraud? I think that's the question we're trying to get at here.
It certainly doesn't, and you can hear actually Secretary Kobach switch when he said, you know, in my office we prosecute that sort of thing. He's brought 9 cases. That's not 90, that's not 900, that's not 9,000, that's 9 cases. And that's pretty much consistent with the incidence of this sort of voting twice in two different states. It happens, but it happens a really, really small amount of the time. So what he said before that is absolutely correct. We have a registration system that is slowly getting better. It's slowly bringing itself into the 21st century. But for a long time, our registration system has worked as if it's still the 1850s or 1860s. A lot of it is dependent on paper. A lot of it's dependent on sort of administrative clerks talking to each other and not talking to each other very well. That's been getting better. And you've seen, I think Van mentioned, state officials and local officials have had more tools to digitize the voter rolls, to encourage people to register online, which helps alleviate errors. If you're putting in your own information online, it's going to be more accurate than if you've got handwriting. I know my handwriting, I wouldn't trust somebody else to read it and type it in accurately. Mm-hmm. You've got programs like that are run by consortiums of states to compare the rolls from place to place. And you've got increasingly sophisticated ways to keep up with people as they move. You know, again, some of the schools I've attended, they know exactly where I live and they follow me from place to place. And our election officials are starting to get the tools to do some of the same things, to modernize the voter system.
That's a really good point. I mean, there's a lot of companies that can follow you wherever you show up, and you would think the voter registration rolls could do the same. But you're saying it's getting better.
Yeah, and we're getting better at that. That's right. It's slower than it should be. It needs a lot more funding. We need to invest in our elections. We too often don't, and then we're surprised by the results. But that is entirely different from the need to sort of get our systems up to speed and up to date is entirely different from whether people are committing crimes by unlawfully casting votes in multiple places. I'm probably still on the rolls, just as Secretary Kobach mentioned, I'm probably still on the rolls in a bunch of states because people haven't yet pulled me off. But I can promise you, I have voted one time in the elections I voted in, and only one time. And that's the vast majority of the public.
I should also say that Secretary Kobach, by the way, again, he's chairing this commission, he's Secretary of State in Kansas, is going to be required to testify today in a federal deposition about requiring Kansas voters to offer proof of citizenship to vote. That's a somewhat separate issue from specifically what he's doing with the commission. But, Van, I think it's also a parallel issue that reveals some of his interests.
I'd say they're not just parallel. They are intertwined.
Are they?
Some of the lawsuits against the commission's work have centered on his proposals or sort of draft proposals to the president to implement a similar reform requiring proof of citizenship to vote nationally or at least to sponsor that kind of legislation. They think it interferes with his ability to be a clear and unbiased presence on that commission. So I think actually this case come out of Kansas and the fact that he has in all of his rigorous prosecution as Kansas Secretary of State, he has convicted one person so far of non-citizen voting. And I think looking at that and looking at sort of how the requirement for proof of citizenship disenfranchises so many people and seeing, you know, basically how his deposition goes and everything is actually going to have a big impact on the long-term mission of the commission and on Chris Kobach's sort of prominence and profile within the administration.
Okay. Call here, I think, from somebody that wants to talk about citizenship. Judy, hi, is that what you're thinking about?
That's exactly right. It's an issue that comes up in I'm from a small rural community in southwestern Minnesota, mm-hmm. and having been a judge myself, I get people coming and saying, I live here, I want to vote. It's my country. And we're precluded by our idea of saying, show me your citizenship. And I know darn well that many of the people that vote are not citizens.
Well, Judy, how do you know that? Because they speak another language? Or, I mean, what would reveal to you that they are not citizens?
Because I'm an attorney and I've represented them in court and I know.
Okay.
And the point is that to prove that they can be on the voter rolls, all they have to do is bring out either some kind of an identification or a billing from a residence that's local. Mm-hmm. That does not prove citizenship. It proves residency.
Okay, Justin, what about this issue of citizenship?
I think actually I want to get into that specifically, but I want to connect it to something that Jerry, your first caller, mentioned, and the Van also mentioned.
Okay.
The question in election policy is, do the costs outweigh the benefits, or do the benefits outweigh the costs? And that's no different from the decisions we make about a whole lot of other things in our lives. So if there are steps that can be taken to cut down on the possibility of fraud or the opportunity for fraud that don't hurt anybody and that don't make it more difficult for eligible people to vote, then we absolutely should do that. And I don't think you'll find disagreement about that across the spectrum, bipartisan way, no matter what you think. We all want to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat. And when there are policies that do both of those things at the same time, we should take them. That's part of why I think there's pretty widespread agreement on cybersecurity for voting systems, for registration systems, for the sorts of tools that officials use. Because making sure that people can't hack into them is something that doesn't create problems for eligible voters and helps to prevent manipulation. And now coming back to the question of proof of citizenship, the question here is, what's the policy that helps really prevent fraud without impacting eligible Americans? And that last part is a bit of the hesitation. So if you're a non-citizen, there's no incentive for you to cast a ballot. It's a crime. You can be put in jail for, I think, up to 5 years and $10,000 for registering, and again, up to 5 years and $10,000 for casting a ballot. If you want to get involved in the immigration system, if you want to naturalize, if you want to become a citizen, that's something that they check before you're able to take steps to become a citizen. And if you voted while you're not a citizen, it's something that can get you deported. Those are pretty serious consequences. And on the other side of the ledger, it's just one incremental vote. So you don't see a lot of incentive for people who aren't citizens to cast ballots.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, on the voter fraud commission, I should say, on voter fraud, and the commission that has been formed, headed up by Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach. President Trump has been talking a lot about it. I gave you some statistics at the beginning of the conversation here. You can check out the Brennan Center's research on this. There are very, very few instances of prosecutions and validated voter fraud. But we thought this would be an opportunity for a conversation about how we define voter fraud. And I know some genuine concerns from voters about this. But of course, there's a lot of politics mixed into this as well, and we have to acknowledge that. Justin Levitt with us, a law professor at Loyola Law School, and Van Newkirk with us, a staff writer at The Atlantic. And so if you're worried about voter fraud, I'd like to know where that worry comes from. If you've checked in a bit on the politics around this, if you have genuine questions about how it might happen, how it might be stopped, some other voter concerns here. Because I want to ask our guests about the other issues that this commission could actually address, if they were so inclined. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR, where Brian says, because Trump's ego can't handle the fact that he won by a fluke of the electoral map, he's talking about politics there. Jessica says, I got married. I changed my name and I moved to Minnesota from Iowa last summer. My parents were convinced that someone like me could vote in both places. And then Jessica says, why would I drive 4 hours to vote twice? And then a call here from Jake listening in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Jake, what do you want to know?
Hey, Jake from Buffalo here. Actually,
hi.
So here's my quick comment. And you mentioned that they did a study. Well, a billion things were checked.
That was the Brennan Center, right?
Yep, and 31 came back as the fraud. So here's my comment or a question about this. If we have this fraud commission, is it okay just to go ahead and look at the situation? Let's see what we have going on, and maybe we'll find something. Maybe we won't, because if we look at it like let's say people who have autism or mental illness, if we looked at it many years ago, we probably had low numbers. But as we learn more and continue on and investigate it more, we start diagnosing it more. So maybe we do start learning more about it. Maybe we learn that maybe there is a little more fraud, or maybe just inconsistencies. And with that information, we could fix things. But we don't know what we don't know. And I'll throw it out to the panel here, but maybe you guys can help me
okay.
form more of my connect what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah. So, Van, to that question of we don't know what we don't know about voter fraud, is that right?
Well, I don't know about that because states certify their election results before they send them on. We have had studies like these from the Brennan Center. We did have a commission under the George Bush White House that looked at the same thing. And I think the conclusions converge. Now, you could make the argument that maybe in today's political landscape, things are changing. There's more of an incentive to cast illegal ballots. I'm not sure if that one holds up. But I do think, you know, we've had rigorous study into election results. We've looked at the chances and the occurrences of fraud. We've seen, I think, how much things like human error, like security problems, just like the basic fragmentation of the system have actually been much more impactful in, say, causing discrepancies in instances of fraud. And I think, you know, we know and state elections officials know that those are the problems and it's not really fraud. I don't think there is any rigorous sort of study or look at election results that indicate that fraud is a big deal. And I don't think if this commission does a similar rigorous study, it'll find the same.
Justin, will you explain what happened when the commission came to states and requested voter information from all of the states? And we should say a number of the states said that they were not going to comply. What were they looking for?
Yeah, and this goes back to the question, actually. I'm a law professor. I'm a researcher. And so more research doesn't bother me as long as it's done well and as long as it's done right. And I think a lot of people look at who's on this commission and they don't trust that the commission is going to be rigorous in its research. A lot of the individuals on the commission have long histories of making wildly inflated claims. And the vice chair, Chris Kobach, there's an example of this. He came out and said there were thousands of dead people who were voting in Kansas. He gave one specific name. He said Alfred Brewer. I'll just give you an example. He died last year. He's casting votes. A reporter went and tracked down Alfred Brewer. He was raking leaves in his yard, which is pretty extraordinary for a dead guy. So you see them making claims that just aren't backed up by the facts. And I think that's why people are worried that this commission in particular isn't staffed in a way to do the serious research that your caller was looking for. A lot of state officials are worried about that, too. And this has to do with their reaction when Secretary Kobach asked for information. So Secretary Kobach put out a request asking states for the publicly available data on their voter files, and he included a lot of things. He asked for name and street address and party affiliation, and there's absolutely no reason for him to ask for party affiliation. He asked for military status. He asked for voter history. He asked for identifying information like partial Social Security numbers and things that he actually should know he wasn't going to be able to get. He didn't describe what he's going to do with the information or why he needed it. Something like party affiliation, for example, is totally irrelevant to what he says he wants this for.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't describe how he was going to keep it secure. He sent the letter, actually, to people who didn't oversee elections. He was sprinting so hard out of the gate that he was just careless up front. He sent it to state officials who don't have election authority. And I think a lot of states said, whoa, 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 whoa. Hold on, step back, tell me what you're going to use this for, tell me how you're going to secure it, tell me sort of down the road why you want this information before I give it to you. And a lot of states said, before I hear that information, before I get more information on what you're going to do with it, I'm not giving you any of the information we collect.
So, Van, we have a restraining order in effect right now from that judge on states having to comply with the request. I was interested in what the implications are of having all of that voter information in one central place, if he would get the information that he wants.
So actually, they've resent the request out, I think, in a more proper way with more of a detail on how they were going to keep the data secure and they were going to use secure transfer methods. So I think that particular sort of concern, which was echoed not only by all of the lawsuits against the commission, but also by a group of congressmen. You know, they sent a letter, sent multiple letters. And I think the one thing they talked about was security. And I think it's still the jury's still out on whether the current process is going to be secure enough because, you know, like we've seen, these when you have this type of repository of data that Justin was just talking about, you have so this incredible wealth of identifiers of things that would be incredibly useful for, say, partisan analysis of voters and, say, for things like looking forward at elections. This is a very rich and valuable data set. And I think anywhere you have a rich and valuable data set of this caliber, you're going to have attempts to breach it, to take the data and to sell it. And so I think states still have sort of a concern over the security, and it will always be a concern moving forward.
Henry in St. Paul called to say, my concern is the number of people with ID systems who couldn't afford to get a birth certificate or go register for one or weren't born in a hospital or places where voting booths are limited. He's worried about voter suppression. To the phones here to Beth in Branson. Hi, Beth. Hey, Beth, are you there?
Yes, but it's Beth in Vernon Center.
So Sorry about that. Okay, thanks. Go right ahead.
Okay. So coming back to a couple of topics that came up at the very beginning of the show, we live in a township that has such a small voting pool, we don't have a choice. We get absentee ballots, and they come. So you know you're registered, you're ready to go. Mm-hmm. My daughter was registered when she left for college, and every election, one of us is running back and forth to bring the ballot, or come home, fill it out, we sign, send it in. So when she left for grad school and went to Iowa, just because she's politically active, she did register right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew she was only registered in Iowa, so there is a cross-check at least going on between Minnesota and Iowa.
Okay.
She didn't get an absentee ballot here, so I knew she was no longer registered in Minnesota.
So the system is working, in at least in your experience with that.
Right, with that. But then coming back, I mean, I never thought about the autism issue, but my son moved out and is off to college, and here his ballot is sitting there. And it just occurred to me, it would be so tempting just to fill out his ballot. I mean, ethically, I wouldn't do it. And then you have that risk of getting caught. Mm-hmm. What if he went to vote in person or tried, and then you get caught? So that kind of gives to the illegal immigrant, the cost is just, it's too big of a risk.
Yeah, Beth, thank you. Justin, I think we have to come back to what you said. The way I think of it is the cure is worse than the disease. I mean, Beth has described a situation where I guess she could have filled out her son's ballot. And there might be opportunities in some places, I guess, to do that. But we have to make sure that what we're trying to cure here it merits the kind of intervention that we're talking about. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly right. And you can think about it this way. So if you walk into a convenience store, you may be able to steal something off the shelf. It may be possible. Most people don't. In fact, the vast majority of people don't. And you could stop the opportunity for anybody to steal anything off the shelf by keeping all of the goods in the back locked up in a safe. But then you'd have a lot fewer sales. It's kind of the same thing in the election process, that there are risks to the system. We do our best to mitigate them, but we try, exactly as you say, we try to make the cure so that it's not worse than the disease, so that we're not causing more problems than we're trying to fix.
And Van, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Justin.
No. And I was just going to say, Beth and people like Beth don't commit crimes all day. It's not that she's just not committing crimes in the election sphere. She's not committing all kinds of crimes. And we rely an awful lot on that. Where we can tighten the system up without hurting anybody, we do. But we have to be careful that we're not hurting people when we tighten the system at the same time.
And Van, this is why I think people bring up the idea of voter suppression, which is an issue in some other ways as well. Making sure that, as I said, the intervention doesn't discourage people who should be voting from exercising that right.
Right. When you talk about the cure, again, being worse than the disease, I'm from the South and I have grandparents, I have close relatives, you know, who are not all that old, who don't have good birth certificates. They weren't born in hospitals. They were born, you know, they were black, born in Jim Crow South. They weren't given proper documentation when they were born. So they don't have necessarily proof of citizenship, or they don't have necessarily proof of birth. They can't go and validate their strict ID with a birth certificate. This is something that happened often in North Carolina when they were going, they implemented their voter ID law. And I think those things actually not just discourage, they actually sort of just disbar people from being able to vote. They discourage another element of people who look at this law and say it's unfair, so I don't want to participate. You've seen this actually happening with the request of the commission. People are saying, I don't want my identity stolen just because I vote. So they're actually taking back their registrations. They're unenrolling in the voting process. So we see people self-disenfranchising now. So you look at all these different elements and you think, are these laws designed to prevent a percentage of votes that may be fraudulent? Are they actually helping? And I think all of the data we have now says they actually just disenfranchise more legal voters than they actually protect against the fraudulent ones.
Catherine in Minneapolis called to say much the same as that. She says, I was an election judge for a while in Minnesota, Citizens for Election Integrity in Minnesota. It's a nonpartisan group. We did a similar study and we found exactly the same results. You'd have to have massive organized efforts to overturn an election. And on Twitter, Marit says, seems easy to check for voter registration in another state when mailing an absentee ballot to another state. The Minnesota registration form asks for prior registration. I'd forgotten about that. So, Marit, thank you for that. 651-227-6800-242-2828 as our conversation about this voter fraud commission continues. So we've talked about some of the instances of fraud. Very small numbers of this, some of the concerns that voters such as yourselves have about it. I want to talk with Justin and Van about some of the serious issues that the commission could confront under the leadership of Kris Kobach. What needs to be discussed on this commission? What are states worried about when we're talking about their voter, their integrity of their voter systems and the machinery, the mechanics of it? On Twitter, at CarrieNPR, back in just a minute to the news now with John Wanamaker. Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie. President Trump is backing Republican legislation that would dramatically reduce legal immigration and shift the nation toward a system that prioritizes merit and skills over family ties. Trump joined with Republican Senators David Perdue of Georgia and Tom Cotton of Arkansas to promote the plan at the White House. The bill so far has gained little traction in the Senate. The president is catching some heat for allegedly describing phone calls that didn't happen. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders has tried to explain that compliments Trump described receiving in calls from the Mexican president and the Boy Scouts did occur, just not on the phone. The president, by the way, getting ready to depart on his first extended vacation since inauguration, a 17-day stay at his New Jersey golf retreat. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has announced a one-day delay in the installation of an all-powerful constituent assembly, saying it will convene Friday instead of Thursday as planned. The body elected last Sunday is empowered to rewrite Venezuela's constitution. Maduro vows he will use it to target his opponents and solidify the socialist system installed by late President Hugo Chavez. Dozens of firefighters are battling a fire at a well-known Tokyo fish market, an area packed with tiny seafood vendors and sushi restaurants. Efforts to bring the fire under control continued late Thursday. The Tokyo Fire Department said no one was injured or trapped because the fire broke out after the shops had closed. On Wall Street, the Dow continues to hover just above 22,000 and up slightly. The NASDAQ, S&P 500, down slightly. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Mashup Americans is your guide to hyphen America. Listen to interviews with mighty mashups like Soledad O'Brien and Hasan Minhaj, and look out for brand new episodes from me, Rebecca Lair, and my co-host, Amy Choi, coming this fall on Apple Podcasts or wherever you jam out.
I'm Tom Weber. Stay with NPR News. 1A is coming up next hour, and then at 11, we'll discuss disparities by race in terms of who gets mental health services in Minnesota. You'll also hear why one man is moving to Minnesota because Illinois is so broken. Join us at 11.
So if you want to be in the audience for the Talking Volumes season launch, September 14th with Sherman Alexie, man, that's going to be a great show. You better hurry. There are about 50 tickets left, and I'd love to see you there. The whole season on sale right now. Check out the Fitzgerald Theater box office or go to the Thread for details, and I'll see you there.
Programming supported by the College of St. Scholastica, an independent private college in the Catholic Benedictine tradition, where a liberal arts foundation combined with strong professional preparation leads to meaningful careers for graduates. CSS.edu.
Back to the conversation now on the Voter Fraud Commission and perhaps some of the more pressing issues that the commission could take up. The Thread question, by the way, coming up at the end of the hour. Justin Levitt with us from Loyola Law School and Van Newkirk with us from The Atlantic, and a call here from Jane in St. Paul. Hi, Jane. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi. I have a slightly cynical comment to make about this issue.
All right.
I think Democrats and Republicans are both equally guilty of wanting to use this as a baseball bat against the other. It's much more valuable as a political issue to gin up your base than it is to actually, none of these politicians really want to solve the problem. You know, if the problem is that some poor or elderly people in North Carolina don't have IDs, who is solving that problem? I mean, that means those people don't have bank accounts. That means they are outside the economic system in this country. And if we all feel so badly about that, who is solving that problem? Why don't we have an initiative to get identification for people so that they can join the economy and have a savings account? Or, you know, I think that's crazy.
Yeah,
the Democrats want to gin up their base by saying that Republicans are racist and anti-poor and are trying to disenfranchise people. And the Republicans want to gin up their base saying, oh, foreigners are stealing your vote and your country. So I think the blame is absolutely across the board.
So
no,
Justin,
one wants to solve this problem.
So what do you think about the politicization of the issue? Does Jane have a point about how both parties use it for their advantage?
Jane does have a point. So I also want to point out there is an organization that's trying to do exactly what Jane wants for exactly that reason, to try and get people ID that don't have it. It's called Vote Riders. It's a small nonprofit, and it does what it can with what it has. But this is a very big country, and there are more people like Van's parents than you might think in it. So individual nonprofits are starting to take steps to go that way as best they can. But Jane has another point, and this comes back to the thread you said you want an investigative. What should we be doing?
Yeah, good.
So 4 years ago, there was a presidential commission that was convened that's very different from this one. So this one is chaired by two people of the same political party, both currently running for office. All right, Vice President Pence, I imagine, is going to be back on the ticket in a couple of years. Secretary Kobach is running for a partisan statewide office in Kansas. And they don't really have a balance on the commission of viewpoints. They don't really have a balance of experiences. And they don't really have a nonpartisan research staff. Compare that to 4 years ago, there was a commission that was picked. It was led by one of the chief Democratic campaign lawyers, longtime extremely well-respected, and one of the chief Republican campaign lawyers, longtime well-respected. It had statewide officials. It had local officials. Because voting has a lot in common with industry in terms of customer service and logistics, and speaking of customer service, thanks to all of your listeners who have served as election judges, there have been more than a few of them so far. That is magnificent.
Right.
So the commission included this one 4 years ago, included people from industry with experience in customer service and logistics. And they sat down together in a very bipartisan way, in a way that was supported by a lot of really good research, and came up with a lot of relatively small, relatively modest, but very bipartisan improvements to the system. Things like getting more money to replace the voting machines that we use, the systems we use to actually cast ballots. Things like better predicting who's going to show up so that we can make sure we don't overinvest or underinvest, that people don't have to wait online for hours, that they can go in and cast their ballots and things work smoothly on election day. Things like making sure your voter registration follows you when you move. Things that lots of people from both parties can agree on. And the tragic thing, and here Jane's right about the incentives that people in the current system has, those recommendations are still out there. Some states are implementing them, but a lot fewer than should be.
So it would be, Justin, it would be up to individual states to take up the commission's recommendations there? That's more likely than some kind of federal law that comes through Congress?
Much more likely. Okay. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, by the way. So we have a very decentralized election system. Most elections are run not even by states, but by counties or cities. And that means that there's a lot of room for improvement and innovation. If you have a federal law, it tends to be more one size fits all. We've got a few that are really important. The Voting Rights Act, the National Voter Registration Act, things that people really are devoted to and take seriously. But these sort of tweaks on the edges of ways to improve the system, there's a lot of merit to having individual states pick them up one by one.
Linda called to say the woman who purported to be a lawyer and knew illegals voted. That was one of our earlier calls, and I'm seeing a lot of Twitter action on this. Linda says she doesn't know that unless she saw them vote, this issue of non-citizens voting. If she saw it, she should have stopped them. To the phones, Van, a call for you here from Merrick in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Merrick. Hey, Merrick, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go right ahead. What do you want to say?
Well, I have two things. One, we own a business, and if we don't ID somebody, we get in big trouble, get tickets and everything like that. To go buy a lottery ticket, to buy cigarettes, to go to the doctor, you have to have an ID to make sure you know, you're doing it right. I don't see why we just don't have that. Second point is there is a different way of doing voter fraud, and you guys have actually done a story about it. And I'm not sure about the right sect of the Jews. But there's schools that actually get shut down, and they bus in people to vote, and they basically shut down schools. And you guys have actually done stories on that.
You know, Merrick, that doesn't sound familiar to me at all. So what I'll do is take up your first question about voter ID. And Van, his question is, if you need an ID for a lot of other things, why not to vote?
I'd actually say, especially for the people who are most affected by voter ID laws, elderly people who live in areas where there are lots of elderly people who don't have this type of ideas, ID is not really an impediment to other parts of your life. You know, people like to say you need an ID to drink, you need an ID to buy cigarettes, you need an ID to say, open a bank account. That's not actually true, say, in North Carolina, if you're elderly. They have lots of ways to get around it. You can, again, provide proof that you have bills at your address. A lot of times you can just get by on sort of people knowing you. You don't need an ID to buy cigarettes or alcohol if you look to be over 40 in lots of places. So actually, I think society in other places has figured out ways to get around the fact that large populations in the United States don't have ID, and it's not because they are at fault. And they have basically built these regulations that have made it possible for these people to participate in the economy. Now, what Justin said before, you know, I think it should be the case that everybody has access to an affordable and useful ID, and they should have something that follows them throughout their life. And there are groups that are working to do that, and I think that should be an easy bipartisan issue to push forward. But the idea that you are totally sort of carved from society for not having an ID, that's just not true in lots of cases.
Justin, I wanted to ask you about what happened with the Supreme Court in the last session declining to take up that North Carolina voter ID law that was struck down by the federal appellate court. Are there other voter ID laws headed potentially to the Supreme Court, and are there other big voter cases that are headed that way?
There are always lots of cases that are working their way through the court system. Some of them get to the Supreme Court, some of them don't. I think actually the courts have been pushing back on some of the most restrictive ID laws. And this comes to something we were saying earlier. Every state, every single one, has some means for you to show that you are who you say you are. Sometimes it's a signature, sometimes it's presenting a bill, sometimes it's presenting a government document, sometimes it's a very specific ID card. The harshest systems don't have the sort of fail-safes that Van was just talking about for people who, you know, if you've got an ID, fine. If you don't have an ID, what are we going to do with you?
Mm-hmm.
And the harshest systems don't have that sort of fail-safe to consider the people who don't have ID. The courts have been pushing back on those. So there were a number of states 10 or 11 or 12 that implemented them, you know, over the last 10 years or so. And in some of those states, the laws have stayed in place. In most of the states, courts have softened the laws or pushed back on the laws or said you have to create an out for the people who don't have this sort of ID. In North Carolina, there is an ID law. The legislature came back and issued one that was much, 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 much more restrictive, much harsher. And the courts took a look at the evidence in front of them and said, you tried to do this in order to change the electorate, not in order to safeguard elections. You did this in order to try and change who was voting. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that. And so courts have actually been pretty strong in pushing back against the worst systems and pretty good at allowing the more reasonable compromises.
A call here from Eric in Chisago City. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Carrie.
Hey, what are you thinking about?
Hey, you know, I used to be in the camp and I thought it was really reasonable as to why shouldn't everybody have an ID? Like a lot of callers have said, I need an ID for a lot of things. Why shouldn't I need an ID to cast my vote? But the data that you guys have described today really pushed me over the other side of the camp and said, it's not worth the cost to try to solve a problem that doesn't really exist.
Well, good to have your call. I'm glad that was persuasive. A call here from James in St. Paul. Hi, James.
Hi. Thanks for letting me call in.
Yeah, sure.
I guess I wanted to kind of maybe broaden the definition of fraud. And the things that are concerning to me and most of the people I know are things like, you know, not being able to audit or really feel secure about the electronic systems. The last time somebody did a major audit, there were quite a few flaws in systems across the country.
Uh-huh.
The idea that, you know, if you cast absentee or paper ballots, oftentimes parts of them are not counted or nullified. And those are much bigger concerns than the idea that maybe a few hundred or even a few thousand illegal votes across the country might get cast.
Hey, James, I'm really glad you brought this up because, Van, I was listening to a discussion a couple of weeks ago about Russian hacking, and there were questions about whether this hacking could extend into, you know, individual voting machines or voting machines in a certain county. And the person, the expert answering the question said, what we need to make sure of is that we always have paper somewhere that we can use to verify the vote. And I thought that sounds so antiquated. But, I mean, is that where we are with some of the questions that James has brought up about the security of our actual voting machinery?
I think that is where we are. And you have seen several precincts, several counties, even some states have resorted to going back to paper ballots, to old manual entry systems, because they couldn't trust the results from their digital systems. Now, that could be the result of hacking. We do know that there was a large-scale, at least attempted intrusion by Russian state actors in election systems for 2016. We don't know how much, you know, that actually affected, if it did at all, the vote. But we do know it's possible. It's very possible. And we have seen sort of other state systems have been compromised. And it's been shown over and over again that voting systems can be compromised. They often have weak security infrastructure. And they often just have irresponsible sort of data management practices. And what we saw actually in the actual proceedings of Kobach's commission was the people who were actually elections officials on that commission. So you have a couple of secretaries of state. You have a couple of people who are involved in other aspects of elections law. They said almost to a person, look, we are concerned about the integrity of our systems. We want to improve on HAVA, the Help America Vote Act. We want to improve on our digital systems that are so antiquated and fragmented and fractured. I talked to Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap. And he said, you know, that's one of the things that impedes him the most in his ability to actually look after fraud, to audit his election results. So the fact that the systems just don't allow sort of ease of access, they often break. And then you have multiple different competing systems. So you have paper systems some places, you have different voter machines elsewhere. They further fragment the system and make it that much more difficult to actually monitor elections.
Van, I really appreciate the insight and the benefit of your reporting on this. Thanks much.
Thanks.
Justin, thank you so much for the time this morning and the benefit of your research on this. Appreciate it. And on Twitter, one last thought here from Call Me Cassandra. She says, why would one try to vote illegally, risking discovery and prosecution? Nobody capable of reasonable thought, the 31 need therapy. It's time for the thread question of the week. I thought we would do this quickly so we can get maybe a few calls in here, Tracy.
Let's do it.
So what is the question?
What makes a good literary villain?
What are the qualities of a great literary villain?
It's true.
Can I put the number out real fast?
Yeah, please.
651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, the qualities of a great literary villain, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Why are you thinking about this?
Well, I thought it'd be interesting to get the writer's perspective on this. So Peter James, who is a thriller writer, a best-selling thriller writer, explained what he looks for when he writes a villain.
I have to say, I've never read Peter James.
Right, so he writes the Roy Grace thrillers.
Okay. Well, new thriller writer.
Yeah, kind of thrillers, that kind of thing. He's looking for a lovable monster when he's writing, avoiding stereotypes, of course. He doesn't want, you know, the man in the black hat lurking in the shadows. He's past
right.
that. And he also checks his villains with a forensic psychiatrist before he writes them. So he's really trying to get the inner workings of their brains down. So for him, a really believable villain is something that makes his writing pop.
I mean, he's working on the psychology, the sometimes delicate and obscured, right, by the public face that you put out.
Right.
Dastardliness of your psychology.
So he wants an unexpected but realistic, potentially lovable villain when he's writing his villains. So that's interesting to see from the writer's perspective what they're trying to craft.
I wonder if his villains are always men.
Because, they're not.
Okay. Really?
Yeah. One of his best-selling books has a woman villain. So
really? I'm going to have to read that.
He's writing across the board.
I was thinking about this because, well, let me grab a call first before I talk about this to Amy in Minneapolis. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Great literary villain.
I heard your question, and I find it very, very compelling because I think a great literary villain is somebody who, first of all, you admire them because they are very clever, but also there's something about them, maybe even their process or just what they're doing, that you can't help but kind of, something about them makes you kind of pull for them.
That's good. They're charismatic, but they're also sympathetic in a way. That's really true, because then we'd be kind of indifferent. The villain wouldn't be interesting if we were indifferent to them.
Right. I feel like Ripley in Patricia Highsmith's Mr. Ripley trilogy
Excellent.
Is the perfect example of
Excellent
what
option.
We're talking about there.
I'm reading a novel called The Widow by Fiona Barton, and the villain is the most unexpected person in the whole story.
Oh.
And yet the more I get to know her, the more I realize just how villainous she really is.
Check it out.
Talk to me on Twitter about the qualities that a great literary villain should possess. It's at Carrie, KerriMPR. And then check out the article. You've probably got it up on the thread page, right? Okay. Trace, thanks.
Thanks.